Welcome to the Human 24 Live on Form podcast. This is a conversation with the people we have encountered and met across our lives. People who have and are still inspiring us with their journeys and ongoing pursuit to fulfill their potential. Experts in their given fields, legacy builders, and people who strive to perform at their very best every moment of every day. We dig into their hows, their whys, what fuels their purpose, and what their ingrained daily habits are that ensure structure continues to defeat chaos. We hope you enjoy. Okay, so today on the Live on Form podcast, we are joined by Samuel Laird. How are you, Sammy? All right?
I'm very well. Thank you, yourself.
Splendid. Yeah, all good. All good. So Sam is ex-Royal Marine Commando and founder of Laird & Co. Mentoring now, which I guess there's a story behind that progression and why you ended up doing the mentoring stuff. So I guess today is just about digging into that and understanding, you know, how you came about that, life experiences, obviously your time in the military. And obviously what you do now is, you know, mentoring people, helping people through these kind of transitions and things like this. So do you want to just expand on what Laird & Co. is about and what you do and why you do it?
Yeah, so thanks for having me on. But so Laird & Co. mentoring, basically right now it's just one-to-one mentoring. You know, I've realized in my life, you know, through the transition of leaving the military into civilian street, it's really good to have people around us that can listen non-judgmentally, that can kind of help us build this roadmap and, you know, give us tools to be able to cope and achieve the goals that we want to achieve, but also to help us find out who we are. That's the big thing. A lot of people don't know who they are. They don't know their identity. They don't know their purpose. So how can they find like the passion to fulfill this purpose? So that kind of, I had a real heart and hunger for that. So I built up Laird & Co. Mentoring and I'm really blessed that I've got someone like my dad as an advisor all the time. He's a doctor. So he gives me quite a lot of good information from his side. And then I've got some really good accountability friends around me who've had to deal with transition from pro sports and such things, another ex-former military. So I get this all the time from all angles and I'm just kind of piecing it all together and making this kind of authentic, unique approach to dealing with mentoring. And then looking down the line, we're going to run some events, which should hopefully be quite life-changing, just building them up slowly, but not rushing anything. So right now it's just the one-to-ones and sharing on social media and things like that, my story and things like that.
Yeah. So tell us a bit more about your story. So You served in the military for a long time. You were in for 12 years, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, just over 12 years, yeah. For
12 years, which is a good stint, right? And then obviously your experience there, you've been places, you've experienced a lot of things that, you know, I guess anyone outside of the military would never have experienced. Mm. And obviously you said about that struggle between transitioning from, you know, military life to civilian life, because obviously it's one of those things that I guess when you're in, you're very much in it. It's, you know, that is your life. You live and breathe it. You know, that's everything you do. That's everything you taught. That's everything you focus on. And then, and where did you find those struggles were? And, you know, how did your experience in the military sort of help? How did it hinder you? How did those sort of things marry up?
Yeah. So from the military to the civilian transition, I found it so much harder than the civilian to the military transition. But we'll go military to civilian. So that was, it's a lifestyle, as you say, the military. It's not a job. It is a pure lifestyle. That is the world that you live in. You live and breathe it. And it's all I knew. I joined it. I signed up 16, joined 17. So my whole adult life up until I was 30 was military. And all I found is when I decided I'd had enough of the military, and I can go into that later of why I wanted to leave, but you have the excitement of wanting to leave. There's something different, new challenges, new goals, but you've never lived a normal civilian life. So you've never, you know, on camp, we have everything. We have dentist, doctor, accommodation, food. You don't need to worry about any of that. And when I left the military, I mean, I didn't make it easy for myself. So I've got a beautiful daughter. She's 12 years old, Heidi now. Me and her mum separated. So she was born in Chorley. And I decided when I left the military, I wanted to be a more present father for her. So I moved to a town, Chorley, where I didn't know anyone and had to start up a life where I didn't know anyone. I ended up having this one bedroom flat due to when I was leaving, accommodation fell through. That all went beat tongue. So I was sleeping on people's couches initially when I left, and it was just a nightmare living outside of my car. Ended up getting this one bedroom flat, had to find work. And it was just one thing after another. And I thought, wow. So I'd gone from an environment where I was surrounded by people that have all... The beauty about the Marines is everyone's achieved that green lid. No matter what kind of person they are, everyone's different. But they've all reached a bar. And that's the kind of people you're around all the time that are essentially high achievers. And then I left the military and I was around like no one. Like, had to create a whole new community, a whole new network, find my purpose again, find out who I was again. And, or not again, find out who I was, because in all honesty, I didn't know who I was because I'd sold myself out to the military. I was a Marine, and that's who I thought I was, to the point even year or two leaving the military, I would introduce, when someone says, oh, hello, who are you? Do you know, I'm Sam. What do you do? Well, I was a Marine. I would never, you know, I had a job, but I always had to go, well, I was a Marine, because I almost didn't feel like, you know, I didn't know who I was. That was the problem. So yeah, identity. I was lucky. I wasn't lucky. I was blessed that I've created a community in Chorley, and I joined a church, and that ended up being the people that I hung around with that were like-minded people. And then obviously you exercise, you meet people in the gym and things like that, and you create your networks again. But the transition was, yeah, chalk and cheese, really tough, different world, military and civilian world, very different world.
And you talk there about almost like the community aspect to it, right? Because you become part of a community.
Yeah.
You know, the military, and you put it akin there to professional sport, which again is a similar sort of thing. It's a community, right? You're surrounded by people with a similar mindset, people who have similar goals, people who are trying to, you know, do what they do, and you know, the people come and go, but they're ultimately all cut from the same kind of cloth. And if they weren't, they're molded into that same kind of cloth. So I guess, you know, when you move into that civilian life, all of a sudden you were saying about having dentists and doctors, all of a sudden you've got to take that responsibility. But what, so I have to find my own dentist. And I mean, you know, you laugh and smile about these things, but all of that adds to that ominous thing that's ahead of you, right? You know, they talk about this, the prison, I can't remember what the term they use for it, where, you know, people spend a lot of
institutionalized. 100%, I was institutionalized.
And was that a bad thing, do you think? Or was that, you know, you used the term sold myself to... I mean, when you were 16 and 17, what made your decision to go into the military initially? Have you got a big family?
I've got a big family, but none of them are military.
Because that's the normal, you know, the normal thing is, you know, you're
either
or your brothers or whatever, and you follow suit, don't you?
Yeah, no, not that. So I always look at things, there's always a push and there's always a pull. So for me at the time, my pushes was I didn't enjoy the education system. I wanted to leave school at 16 and I didn't want to go down the same path as my brothers and sister and all my friends of A-levels and university. It just wasn't, I couldn't think like that. And I didn't want to be in my house at the time. There was some family matters going on and I wanted out of that. And then the pull factor was I did have an uncle who was high up in the PSNI, which was the RUC in Northern Ireland. I always looked up to him. But then also the big one for me was for the, because everyone, I know you've had Jay Morton on here and he got told Paras or Marines. Same thing with me. Which one should I join, Paras or Marines? It had to be an elite unit. And I'd been away with the Paras for a weekend, but when I did judo as a child and there was a guy called Manny there who was a Royal Marines commando, and me and my friend Chris Rogerson, we proper looked up to this man. He used to come in running in late on a Friday night. It just drove down from Arbroath, the 4-5 commander where I ended up going. Like 4 hours straight into judo mats, do judo with him. He was just this bubbly character and he'd let us know what he'd been up to that week. And me and Chris used to be like, that's who we want to be. So I ended up signing up for the Marines, obviously, to be like him. And my mate Chris ended up actually joining down the line. And that story goes further, actually, that we actually ended up all serving together in the same company, in the same unit in Afghanistan, in the same FOB. So, you know, there's only different FOBs, different sizes. This is a company strength FOB. So, you know, around about 100 people, 120 people. And the three of us were there. And then, unfortunately, he actually died on that tour. He got a suicide bomber, came over and blew himself up, Birchie up and Damo up, and all three of them died. So, but it were quite, and that was a big transition for me as well of finding out who I was, because this man had He was one of my pull factors. He joined the Marines. I'd always looked up to him, ended up serving by his side, and then he was gone. And it was like, oh, okay.
And this was Manny, the guy, the judo guy.
Yeah, John Henry Manuel. Yeah.
And he was what? He was significant. Was he older than you?
Yeah, he was older. So he's quite like a father figure, you know, really looked up to him. So it really, no, it was really good that me, Chris, and him got to serve side by side after me and Chris looked up to him as children. But yeah, very, very hard time for myself in my life. Yeah.
Okay. So, went off the, you know, on a tangent, I guess, with respect to whatever all your other brothers and you know, your father and family and everybody else done. So you decided 16, 17, I'm going to join the Marines.
Yep.
So was it an instant join the Marines or was it join the army, then make a call on the Marines? Or was it straight in, this is where
no. go, this is the path? So all I wanted to do was join the Marines. It wasn't a simple process. I'd actually... In the process, I failed my medical due to there was blood in my urine, so I had to have a kidney operation to get a biopsy to check. And interestingly enough, actually, my dad only told me this the other week that after my biopsy, they went, "Yeah, okay, he's got a mild case of whatever it was. We'll check up on him again in 12 months." And my dad pulled the doctor aside and said, "No, you won't. Like, if you say he needs to be seen in 12 months, he's not going to get into the military. They'll not let him in." So the doctor signed me off, and I only found that out the other week. And so I got signed off, and then obviously went through the process of joining the Marines, had the PRMC 3 days. The Marines is different to the Army. So the Army, I know if you're under 18, you have to go to the foundation college, I think, first, and then you go on to the things. Marines, at 16 and 3 months, you're in with the men. So everyone's the same and everyone does the same job. You just can't go on tour till you're 18. So I ended up joining 17. There were 60 people in my troop in training and 11 of us finished. And then I actually were 18 in training, left and went straight into operations into Northern Ireland. And then obviously Afghanistan kicked off and we were there for the rest of my career.
So I just want to dig into that number a little bit, because this has actually been mentioned to a couple of guys we've talked about, you know, the number that go in and the number that actually qualify and get through. So it was 60 went in, and obviously there's this, and again, from what I've gathered from other people I've talked to, is that there's this kind of media depiction of what, and films and blah, 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 of this whole thing where you get hammered into the ground to the point that they shout at you, screaming a bit like the TV show, right? And they shout and scream at you, and they do everything they can to push you over the edge so you don't make it through. From what I've been told, that isn't the case. The case is they actually want you to get through and they encourage you and do everything they can to get you through. It's just the fact that the sheer difficulty of this process that you get this high attrition rate, right? So the 60 gone in, there's only 11 got through it, right? So what happens to the other 50 odd, 40 odd?
So just going back to what you're saying there about that wanting you to get through, I would say that's more, I mean, I've listened to your podcast, and that's guys talking about joining special forces.
Yeah,
they are not there to fail you. You know, you've all already reached a high standard of soldier, and then you're going in there to do that. So they don't need to fail you because you'll fail yourself. Where in training, in basic training, it's like they want you to fail. It's like they don't want you there. That's when the shouting happens.
Right. So when you went in at 16, 17, they're giving it to you, right?
Oh, they're giving it to you. And when you're 17, you don't think it's a game. Wait, I realized some of the older guys, you know, so my oppo in training, you always end up buddy-buddy system. Now, he actually dropped out week 15, but he was like 27, 28. I used to think he was mega old, but like none of the games seemed to bother him. And I'm like, how does this not bother you? And I just think as you get older, you realize that's a game, that where everything the training team said to me, I thought, if I'm not there on time, that's me done. If I haven't done this exactly right, I'm done. So it was pressure from day dot. And they're straight into you. I mean, for me, the hardest part of training were the first 2 weeks. And then after that, I just got stronger and stronger and stronger. But that was just because I was wet behind the ears. You know, I didn't know how to iron. I was up ironing at 4 a.m. when everyone was getting their heads down, you know. And
so do you think it was more mental? Was it more mental or physical?
At first, I think it's mental, just because the unrealistic times to give you, you know, you'll be in one set of rig and they'll go, right, you've got 5 minutes, go and get your scran, eat that, back here, different rig, out here. It's set up to fail. It's set up that you will not be there on time, and then they're going to thrash you and all this. Yeah. It's just a mind game. See how much they're just building that resilience. And then when you kind of get to, I can't remember exactly what time it is, about week 15, then you actually start going into the soldiering phase of it, you know, actually learning your commando skills. But by then, you've already proven that you've got your resilience. You've already proven that you are physically fit. Now you can really start to enhance your skills. But I would say the start of training is just all about seeing who you are.
So at that point, so 2 weeks in, right, how many guys are left? Or how many guys have dropped out?
Not many drop out in the first 2 weeks. I'd say it's the young guys that struggle the most, because we're learning simple life skills, you know, where the older guys are just, they kind of breeze through that. The older guys struggle later on when you've got like your commando tests and things like that towards the end, your bottom fields, that's when they are not enjoying it. And the young lads start to, you know, most people lose weight in training. I think I put on 10 kilos. I was a young lad, so I was just, they feed you. You have to eat 4 times a day. You can get charged if you don't have your meals in the day. So you just, how it's fueling the system, obviously training however many times a day you train with them. You know, so I would get bigger and stronger and faster.
What was your temperament like at that point? So you said, you know, school academia wasn't your thing, which is the case with loads of people, right? It's not for everybody. It's not something people find necessarily easy, or they just don't enjoy it, or there's a combination of both, or there's, or they just kind of rebel against it, I think there's a lot of people at that kind of age. You're like, yeah, I want to do this. It all sounds a bit, and it doesn't, it's hard to rationalize, I think, a lot of that stuff. You know, when you're looking at academia, there's certain things you're doing. Why am I doing this? I was always like that through school. I was just like, I don't understand what am I going to use this for? That was always the thing. So what were you like at school? Were you rebellious? Were you troublesome? Were you,
what was it? When I speak to most military people, they usually say that they were rebellious in school and did all this and that. I had my rebellious time in my 20s when I was in the Marines. But when I was at school, I'll be honest, I was the quiet guy. I did get bullied a bit. You know, I got punched at my first day of high school for wearing glasses. So I was quiet, and I wasn't a lover of education, but I wasn't daft either. You know, I got 11 GCSEs, you know, above C. I wasn't thick. It just, I knew it wasn't the route for me. I've always been like that. I think it's, I always have to veer off, you know, like you're self-employed people, I think, are just like that, aren't they? You know, I don't want to be part of that timetable. Although obviously when you join the military, you're part of a timetable, but you've still veered off the normal track of life. I was quite an emotional child. And then some family situations happened that kind of filled me with anger. And if I look back, I was probably fueled by anger for a lot of training, a lot of my younger 20s. And then you grow up and get a bit mature. And I would say I've gone back now to I'm more like what I was as a child now to what I was as a young Marine. I'm a lot more empathetic, a lot more trying to get more emotional and understanding and open up my heart a bit, where in the Marines, you just become closed, especially when you go through, you know, multiple tours. You know, I've done 3 tours of Afghan, 2 7-months, 1 6-month. I spent a long time over there, and you become very numb to things. So I'm almost trying to rip that apart again now. I don't want to be numb. I want to feel things. So I would say I'm trying to go back to what I was, back to my roots in a way.
And I guess that, you know, there's a lot of stuff you see, obviously, that again, a lot of people can't even contemplate. I mean, I can't even fathom it. It's you know, where you've got to deal with a lot of stuff that I guess you either get emotional about at the time, which doesn't serve you any purpose, I guess, or you kind of bottle it up, or you're totally oblivious to it, which I guess there's pros and cons of each approach, right? I guess the guys who are just completely oblivious to it and it doesn't affect them, and then there's other ones who, you know, bottle it up and, you know, stick it up the jumper for 10 years, and then all of a sudden it sort of starts to creep out and surface, doesn't it, which I guess results in, you know, PTSD and various other problems. And then you've got, you know, the actual just dealing with it, where you open up about it and sort of talk about it or do whatever you do. So, you know, is that something that's been part of this military to civilian life for you? Was that a large part of it, or was it the actual,
yeah,
we said about institutionalization, Was that the difficult part, or was the difficult part, or was there a combination that was the difficult part, the institutionalized element alongside the traumatic element of just simply being in the military, right, and seeing the things you see?
Yes, it's never as simple as one thing, as you know, but, you know, I would say, you know, those situations when they occur, when you're out on tour, I don't know many people, if any, that I've seen kind of be emotional at the time. I would say the majority either bottle up or like you said, they kind of shrug it off. And everybody has to come to terms with that at some point. It'll come and bite you at some point. You know, we had some university people came in and they were studying us, and they basically were saying it worked for some reason. The data might have changed now, but they were saying to us it takes about 8 years for a traumatic incident to really, really? Kick in and start affecting your life. And when you looked at it, and I was looking at kind of my wild times and stuff, I thought, oh, yeah, maybe that's about 8 years after that traumatic incident. And also how you deal with those is also a lot to do with if you've had trauma as a child and stuff like that, and how you dealt with that trauma is how you're going to deal with that trauma in adult life and such things. And then, but then when I left, yeah, so yes, there was the transition of being institutionalized into civilian world. But yeah, dealing with those things when you're in the military, the culture that I was in at the time did not deal with stuff. It was a very old school culture. I would say from what I'm hearing, it's great to hear that it's not that culture anymore. That's not to say that culture won't exist, but it's become less and less so. So, you know, obviously gone are the days now where men can't show emotion and talk to someone. Like, I would recommend that most people have therapy, even if you think you're all right, go and have therapy and go and have a chat and see whether you're all right.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
And that is a taboo in the middle. Like, people just wouldn't do it back then. If I actually remember hearing that guys were struggling and were like, I remember being annoyed by it. And then lo and behold, you know, I ended up struggling down the line. And it was just the culture. I was like, nah, you're soft. What do you mean? Like, we joined for this. And I couldn't comprehend how these people were struggling it for something that we signed up to do. And then obviously I ended up struggling myself and understood it more. But getting to my point, sorry, when you get into civilian street, I almost feel like that's the first time you can switch off, because you've been on this, you know, for me, it was just, you know, like tour for my career. And there's no time to kind of really sit down and go, okay, this is what happened. Let's deal with that. Let's process that. There was none of that. So then when I left, it was just kind of like, it was like a release. And I broke down when I left. Yeah. You know, I kind of kept it under wraps the best I could, but, you know, I ended up, you know, walking away from the job I was in, and just, I spent a year just focused on me. I got help from a charity called Rock to Recovery. I went and did therapy with horses. I threw myself into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I mean, it worked out all right for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu because I won some big tournaments, but I just had to really just get into my faith and just work on me again and find out who I am and go through that whole process. And it's not a nice process, but a process I'm so grateful I've been through. So yeah, there's multiple reasons why lads struggle when they leave, you don't even know I've had to have seen combat. You know, yes, I did, but I know plenty of lads that haven't seen combat that have left the military and still struggled in civilian life with the transition. And at the end of the day, everyone's dealt with traumas. You don't have to have gone to war to have traumas. Oh, no. Do you know what I mean? Like, everyone's gone through trauma. And it's whether or not they've dealt with that trauma, whether it's going to bite them in the backside down the line.
And it's also those levels that you talked about. You know, you said about sort of special forces, everybody's at a level, you know, it's your level of tolerance, right?
Yeah.
And resilience, right? And, you know, you look at somebody else who's struggling to cope with something that you would maybe look at and go, that's super trivial, right?
Yeah.
Super trivial. You know, why are they having a meltdown about this? Why are they worrying about it? Why are they stressing about it? But to them, that's not trivial. That's quite significant.
And yeah. And with a lot of that, it's usually they've had the bigger trauma, and it's the trivial thing that puts you over the edge. Yeah. It always is. It's always a trivial thing that's when your glass is overflowed. It never seems to be the big event that breaks people. That's filled their glass up, and then it's something small and trivial that just, and that's when people go, why are they behaving like that over that? Like, that's nothing, but they don't see everything that's behind that. That's it's a big thing to realize when you see people struggle.
Yeah, that statistic you said about the 8 years, I mean, that's fascinating. That it's you know, that you can take a traumatic event, you know, for anybody, it could be a death in the family, it could be, you know, whatever, and it takes 8 years for that to process. And like you said, it's that time when you get that peace. It's a bit like, you know, I think I heard someone analogize it as a bit like, you know, the old school cameras, is that you're constantly taking pictures until you take that film that me and you know that you used to take to Boots or wherever it was, develop it, until you get a chance to develop the pictures, you don't get a chance to process them. You don't get a chance to look at them and remind yourself and blah, blah, blah. And I heard someone, I can't remember, I think maybe on another podcast, where somebody had analogized throughout the military as, you know, you take that film and a couple of years after you've left, you go and get it processed.
Yeah.
And then when it gets processed, you then, you know, you almost get this flashback of all these things that have happened in this film, the things you've taken this mental, you know, picture of, and all of a sudden they're laid out in front of you again. And you never, before, you never took the time to look at them and absorb them and blah, blah, blah. And I guess that's also that thing where, you know, people go into the military expecting all this combat and expecting all this thing. And I guess to some degree, it's probably traumatic not to get that.
100%.
Because you're wound up for that, right? You know, it's a bit like training for years for a job, and then, you know, your dad's a GP, is he, or a...
A pain consultant, an anaesthetist. Right. Yeah.
So it's like him training for 10 years to do that, and then going out there and finding out nobody wants what he's trained for, you know, which I guess in itself is hugely traumatic, right?
100%. And you're training people up to, exactly as you say, to do this job, and then to not do it, there's something built up inside of them there that needs to release, you know, and that's where you need to watch people on the street. You know what I mean? It's guys are walking around with a lot of aggression in them, and it needs vented out in some way, shape or form. But no, that's exactly it. You've summed it up to a T, really.
So jiu-jitsu, you said about jiu-jitsu, was that part of that aggression thing? Because again, it's a you know, you explain you've done jiu-jitsu. I'm an amateur when it comes to jiu-jitsu, but I get martial arts, and I understand. I mean, I've done martial arts on and off for most of my life, so I understand the mentality. And I remember, you know, seeing a couple of lads at school who were real loose cannons, and they took up martial arts, and you were like, oh my God, they're going to be loose cannons, dangerous now. And actually they weren't. They became very honed, but they were more composed, and they understood themselves more, and they had more composure, more skill. And I guess that's jiu-jitsu, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I started off with judo. I actually got my black belt the same year I got my Green Beret for the Marines. So it was a good year for me. I peaked way too soon, 2003. So I joined Marines 2002, got green lid 2003, got black belt. And then I went up to my fighting unit, and there was a guy called Dean Robertson up there. He had an MMA club. So I started doing the MMA training with him. And obviously Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at that time, so UFC was quite young in its days then, and we were doing that, and obviously everyone looked up at Royce Gracie and stuff then. And so got well into that, and we were competing back then. I ended up going over to Brazil on my own in 2005. I got my blue belt over there. I got told at a time off Carlos Gracie Jr. I was the youngest ever foreigner to get the blue belt, as in the quickest, sorry, not the youngest, the quickest, because I was only there 2 weeks and he gave me at the end. But it's only because we did a stand-up day, and obviously I was a black belt in judo, and I was throwing around his black belts and brown belts in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Right. Obviously on the ground, it was a different ball game altogether. They absolutely annihilated me. Yeah. But so I did that, and then I went back again in the Easter, and that started my journey off with the Brazilian jiu-jitsu. But then moving forward, like obviously leaving the military, it was just, for me, it wasn't so much the aggression, it's the community again. The Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu community is almost the closest like-minded community I've got to the military. You know, everyone's very humble. You know, some of the best people are in there. They're not the big steadheads with tattoos on their head. They're the little skinny geek. They're the ones that'll tie you in knots. And I love that, you know, because probably inside I'm this little skinny geek, although I might be covered in tattoos now. But so I threw myself into that, and it ticked a lot of boxes for me. I mean, one thing I will say, and I've said it before on other podcasts, is that I used Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu that year probably in the wrong way to deal with my mental health, as in I was using it as an escapism. rather than, yes, this is a good coping mechanism. Yeah. You know, there's obviously many good coping mechanisms. Physical exercise is one, but I was training twice a day hard. And then I was competing as much as I could. And then obviously I went over to New York and I won the Pan Ams over there. And it was just, boom, I just wanted to compete. Fought in Grapple Fest, which is, you know, one of the biggest shows in Europe here. And all I wanted to do was compete and be the best at that. But I just throw myself all into that. And I was like, hold on, there's another life outside of here. I need to actually work out on getting a job or what am I doing and things like that. So, but with regards to ticking boxes, community, physical exercise, it's a form of meditation. You can't think about your worries while someone's trying to choke you out. It's simple as that. So you get that kind of escapism for the hour or two you're there. There's loads of benefits Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, although I haven't been back since COVID, but yeah, I'll be back. So I'm only a brown belt Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I'm not a black belt. I am. But...
I was going to ask where you were in there.
Yeah, I'm a brown belt. Yeah.
So what else was, you know, what else did you do to deal with your own stuff? Because obviously, you know, you're doing this for other people now. You're mentoring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you used Jiu-Jitsu as a mechanism to start with, and then obviously tailored that and refined that into a different type of mechanism. Mm. What else did you do there to get that transition right?
So, initially when I left, I worked in a school. So I was mentoring. It was a PRU, so children that have been expelled from mainstream school and they go into these schools temporarily. So I got a lot of the mentoring stuff. I learned a lot from mentoring them, but when I left that and did my year, because then I had my breakdown, then I did my year of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I realized, you know, physical side of it does help with the mental health. So that's when I got my PT quals, went off and became a PT, started my own business in that, Assault Fitness UK. And I was helping people with the mental health through PT. What I found out during that process, well, number one, I didn't really like the PT industry. So I never worked in a gym. I always kind of stayed in a studio or train people outside, and I always used to say, if you're after vanity training, go and find another PT. Like, I'm here so you feel better about yourself. Yes, looking good is going to be a byproduct of what we do in this gym, but it's not my sole purpose to give you a six pack. And then I learned from PT, and that I loved the mental aspect so much more than the physical, and the physical was just one part of it. So then I made the decision to step away from PT and go, I'm going to get into mentoring now. And I can advise people now on, you know, do this exercise. But essentially, you know, for the basic person that doesn't want to be a pro athlete, it's just about moving and eating well, eat less calories, burn more calories, you know, all that. That's the basics. Like, do the basics right for a healthy lifestyle and you're going to be happier. And then work on the mindset, and your mindset's, you know, for me, that was hard because I, you know, you've got to rip things apart. You've got to be really ruthless to yourself. And the only way you can do that is to have people around you that will challenge you. So for me, my circle of influence is small, but it's every person who I speak to around my circle is someone I look up to and someone that will challenge me. They won't take no nonsense. You know, you got to be honest. You got to be accountable for what you're doing. You got to be authentic. You got to be who you are. And I'm really grateful that I've got those kind of people around me. It's so key. And then I have therapy, and I believe that helps a lot as well. So, you know, they'll get things out of you that you didn't know are in you. And then you've got to deal with that. It's about facing those demons, dealing with them, moving forward. So loads of it is, as I said, it's not just one thing. You've got your physical aspect, have your friends around you to be accountable for, have someone mentoring you, have a therapist, you know, loads of different aspects to how to deal with your mental health.
I think there's so many things there that were, you know, we go back generationally, right? Is that, you know, we're probably similar age. I think I might be doing you a disservice there, but I think we were very similar sort of generation, right?
Yeah.
You know, everything was about, you know, you don't talk about your problems, especially if you're a bloke.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you kind of, you bottle it up, you deal with it, you contend with it. And obviously there's stuff now coming out, and you said about that change in the way the military are, but I guess there had to be a learning process there based off that, you know, you said about the 8 years, right? By the time a lot of people had left and, you know, they were totally disassociated with the military probably 30 years ago, right? By the time they'd left, nobody was paying attention to them 8 years later.
Yeah.
Going, wow, this was a, you know, this occurred because of what happened 8 years before when we were, you know, it's a bit like, you know, having a job and the job causes all this trauma.
Yeah.
But you know that trauma isn't going to come to the surface for 10 years. The people that you employed you 10 years before, they're not bothered right at that point. Care. And they'll quite happily blame it on something else, or they maybe got just cause to blame it on something else in some cases.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you're talking a transition of that long, almost like an incubation period of 8 years, you know, until somebody starts to study that, and, you know, I'm a man of science, is that I'm looking at data, right? And you're looking at a data set and going, right, hold on, there's a pattern here. And I guess it took them a long time to go, hold on, there is a pattern here, is that we're now looking at the aftercare. And, you know, again, other conversations I've had with sort of special forces and things like this, where, you know, they're talking a lot about this. What do we do for people when they leave? This is the same conversation that professional sports having right now.
Yeah.
Is that there's so many sort of federations and charities and things put together now for that transition of what happens after sport.
Yeah.
Or what happens when these people move away from this thing that was such a huge part of their life and was this institution that they were part of. Now, all of a sudden they're told, that's it. See you later. Get on with it. And I guess that's a, you know, it's a massive thing, right? And you know, the therapy thing you said about, I'm a massive fan of that. I think that's something where there's so much stuff, I think, particularly, well, for men, women alike, is that that just gets bottled up and, you know, tucked away, that does need brought to the surface, needs kind of into, and you need to go, right, okay, so why do I do that? And why do I still act like that? And why do I react like that? And blah, blah, blah. And it, you know, it pulls all that together, which I think is fascinating. So how much of that does that play a part with what you do now? So do you have people that you consult with, or other people that come on board, or is it largely just a life experience thing and you're pointing people in the right direction? So you might speak to someone you mentor and go, look, I think you will benefit. And that, you know, I remember this from PT days, right? Is that if I've got someone with an injury, I need to consult with another professional for them to then push them back to me. And this is how I used to work a lot with, you know, I'd hand them over to somebody. They'd give me a bunch of information that I was never going to be able to conclude.
Yeah.
Pass me that information back with that person. Mm-hmm. I'd do my bit, pass them back again. And it'd be this thing. So is that a lot of what you're doing now?
Yeah, 100%. And what you're doing there, actually, that's very unique, I would say, as well, because there's too many people that think they know it all and can do it all. So, I'll pass people on to other people. And I have plenty of names, whether that's strength and conditioning, working out, or whether that's they need to go more scientific, or I need to signpost them to go and get, you know, I am not a counsellor. So although when you're doing mentoring, I mean, you will listen and things like that, but I'm not a professional counsellor. So signposting is so important, and go, look, that's above my qualification. Go see them, come back to me. Exactly what you're saying, but too much, a lot of people don't like to do that, you know, but that's where you really genuinely care about the person. And that's what that comes down to. And that's exactly it. So yeah, I have lots of people that will give me advice that I can pass on, and also that I can send on to. So 100%. But also, just going back to what you were saying there about, you know, coping with stuff as well, and how to deal with stuff. The way the military dealt with stuff when I was in, after a tour of duty, they send you to Cyprus for 2 to 3 days, supply you with alcohol, and go, there you go, free for all. And all that happens is all the lads get drunk, all the lads get fighting. It's all poof, explodes for 3 days. That's your decompression. That's what they called it. And then you would fly home to your family. And they was hoping that was the way of dealing with it, that you wouldn't go home and beat your wife, you know, because, oh, you've got it all out of your system in 2 or 3 days of alcohol. And a big part of the military culture when I was in, definitely a big part for me, was alcohol, massive. And I fully jumped in 2 feet, loved every minute of it at the time, and drank far too much when not on tour. And again, so going back to what I do now, mental, I stopped drinking. I don't drink alcohol because I couldn't see a benefit in my life. And if something costs you more than money, then it's time to stop. And then go on with what you're talking about, the transition of athletes are getting to the top and then leaving, you know, that happens so much. And I know so many people in that world, you know, one of my best mates, Sinead Reid, she was, you know, an Olympic athlete, two-time Olympian, multiple-time world champion. She literally got brought in a room and gone, like, basically services no longer required. Boom, yeah, yeah. Go and find yourself a new life. Well, what? Been cycling since you were 11 years old. And that's not a one-off story. That's a common story. And then I've found now, yes, even the military, so you'll get kind of three lots of £2,000 to spend on courses. And I know that sports teams, I was speaking to a rugby team recently, and a coach was saying that they all had to get either a degree or apprenticeship while they're in. I thought, wow, that's really good. But although that's really good, getting these qualifications, what you find is, like a lot of the Marines I knew, guys were doing like project managers courses. So they'd spend all their money on, or the Marines' money and a bit of their money on these courses. And then they'd leave, they'd go and apply for a project manager's job, and they'll go, what experience do you have? I'll go, well, nothing. I've been in the Marines all my life. Yeah, sorry, there's no job for you here. And guys had all these qualifications. Yeah. What use are they? No use. You know, guys don't know your transferable skills, so you're in the job. Or unless you sell yourself properly, which you're not told to do. You know, when I left to go get a job, I put myself at the bottom of that organization. When I worked in the school, I didn't even think of looking at management role, but in the Marines, I was in management role.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought, no, I'm down here. You know, nobody teaches you your transferable skills well enough. But again, also, it comes down to knowing who you are. So when you leave the military, a lot of guys are just money orientated or family orientated. They never actually think about what they want to do. They just think, oh, so, you know, I was guilty. I did my close protection course, be a bodyguard and all that. I thought, great, great money. And then I left and thought, but that's not the lifestyle I want, because I want to be a more present father, and everything to do with the close protection industry is being away from home, yeah. You know? And then if you think, oh, well, I want to be with my family. Yeah, okay. Now, how are you going to provide for the family? What are you going to do? What do you like doing? There's so many elements to it. And no one at the time when you're an athlete, to my knowledge, and no one at the time when you're in the military goes, hold on, what do you think your passion actually is? What did you like before the military? What have you loved in the military? How can we transfer that into something you'd really enjoy doing? And let's get that process going. You know, when you sign up, when you sign off to leave the military, you've got to give 12 months notice. And in that 12 months, you're mud in the military. No one wants to know you because you're leaving the brotherhood. And at the same time, they still want your time. They don't want you going off doing courses. They want you till your bitter end. So, you know, you find yourself cramming a load of courses in the last 6 weeks of your career, and then thinking you're going to walk off and get a job. And that's not the case. And it's not the case for most athletes, which is why so many just leave and do struggle with alcohol and drugs, because that's how they coped with it when they were an athlete in the military. But you can get away with it when you're an athlete or military, because you're training every day, you're fed, you're watered, you get paid every month, you get away with it. You can't get away with it when you're a civilian trying to find a new career. So I know I've gone on a bit there about all that stuff, but it's close to the bone. But yeah, so there's something missing with the transition, and that's why my heart is so much into it, because it's not even good enough to go, yeah, great, we've got everyone a degree, nice one, what they're going to do with it.
And it's kind of picking the wrong tools for the wrong job, isn't it? I mean, the alcohol thing I kind of get. And really, it's logical, isn't it? It's the Cyprus thing. It's kind of logical. It is in many respects, isn't it? You look at it and go, yeah, that's kind of logical. Just let people let the hair down for a few days, and they'll be fine. And it is logical, but it also doesn't make any sense either. It's one of them weird things, isn't it? And I guess for some people it works, right? I guess some people it's, you know, that's all they need. They need a little blast and whatever it might be. Maybe not in that scenario, because it's, you know, but when it comes to taking a break from work for normal people who are, you know, they're in a job that, you know, having a few days away, getting drunk for a few days, partying, probably not fighting, not necessarily, but, you know, they're not trying to deal with pent-up aggression. They're just trying to wind down. So they go away, you know, typical, you know, 9-to-5 job, they have a couple of days, they party, they drink, they relax, they sit on the beach, they come back, they're refreshed, they're good.
Yeah.
You know, so logically it kind of works, but then there's kind of a lot more on your plate at that point, right?
Yeah.
Here's a bunch of drinks, and you go and, you know, do whatever you need to do and come back and everything will be cool. But I guess it doesn't work that way, does it?
Well, I mean, there needs to be a better process. The amount that they know about mental health now, I mean, even the stuff, you know, that you're doing, about, you know, even supplements for sleeping and things like that. You know, like when my mate Manny died over there, I didn't sleep for 2 nights. I didn't sleep at all. 72 hours I was awake, you know, and no one's there to sit you down. You know, in the end, I tried to take sleeping medication, didn't work. In the end, I was just so tired. I slept, you know, and I'm still working and functioning during these times, you know.
Yeah.
But no one's there to like go, look, this is what you need. What's your sleep hygiene? You know, talking about melatonin, serotonin. You say, all right, you can't always get your circadian rhythm and stuff when you're on tour of duty. Okay, because obviously you're on sentry at nighttime, you're doing night patrols, day patrols, all that stuff. But you know, when you leave that environment, that's the kind of stuff they should be doing in decompression, right? Guys, this is what we need. You need to get into a routine again.
Let's almost like a, again, I don't want to use the term, but like almost like a retreat, right?
Exactly. Right? That's what off, a decompression should be. Yeah, exactly.
You go off and you walk in the morning, you have a good healthy breakfast, you do a bunch of movement, you get some sunlight, you know, you do a lot. And the problem is it sounds all a bit wet, doesn't it? All sounds a bit wishy-washy and a bit kind of, and that's the problem with a lot of this stuff, right? A lot of the stuff we talk about is you talk about it and people go, you know, I've hold on, wait for it. Right. So I have an SAD light on my desk because, and I've talked about this before, the house faces the wrong way. So when it starts to get dark in the morning, I wake up, I go into an office and I'm not getting any daylight for the first hour of my day, which means firstly, I'm not waking up properly, which means that my mood isn't improving. I'm not, you know, so my choice is either go to the back of the house where the sun rises. But now it's getting to the point, you know, mid-September, is that soon that isn't going to work.
Yeah.
But for me, I just come in my office now and I turn this on and away I go.
You're in my thoughts this morning on my walk because I got my light, but I did my test out my window before this podcast.
Check it.
250.
Crazy, eh?
And you're saying we need 30,000? Is that right?
You need 1,000 just to stimulate serotonin.
Okay.
You need 10,000 for a minimum of 30 minutes to stimulate produce enough melatonin when you sleep.
Yeah,
but most of these lights will emit like 30,000. You'll get. Did you clock it outside?
I didn't clock it outside, but it was a sunny morning. I was out for an hour, so
clock it outside. When you go outside, clock it outside and see what it's like. But it's incredible the difference between being in a room that is lit and you think, I'm in light, to walking outside and looking up at the sky. And you know, you don't have to walk around looking up at the sky, but it's just that exposure to it, which is an incredible thing. And people don't marry these things up; they don't match them and go, hold on, you know, it's like, you know, and all of these things, you know, and again, maybe we're talking a little Hollywood here, but you know, when people torture human beings, they take light away. They take light away. They remove fluid. They starve people. They isolate them. They remove them away from people. Right. So all of that stuff is, you know, and I mean, there's experiments out there, experiments that have been done, you know, decades and decades and decades ago, they'll confirm all this stuff. But it's like all of this stuff that we're led to believe that is bad for human beings, people do to themselves on a daily basis. People isolate themselves. You know, the COVID pandemic, right? One of the biggest issues of the COVID pandemic is isolation, right? You know, I talked, I think on the last podcast to somebody about this, and for men, right? And, you know, and we talked about alcohol. The pub, probably in our father's day, was where men dealt with their mental health issues.
Yeah.
Went to the pub, had a couple of drinks, which allowed them to relax and be, you know, a little bit more open. And they talked to their mates about their problems. Yeah. And all of a sudden.
What's the biggest punishment in prison?
What is the biggest
getting put in isolation, isn't
isolation,
it?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Remove you away.
It's worse to be in isolation than it is to be in a cell with murderers, rapists. Yeah, it's a bigger punishment to be in isolation. Yeah. That's how bad it is for you.
Crazy, and I think people miss that trick, and I think that's why there's such a huge demand, not just in the military, but I think across the board for people doing what you're doing right now, and that's joining those dots.
Yeah,
go and look. There's a huge amount of different people that can help you, you know, achieve what you want to achieve, and you're almost like the catalyst of that. You know, you're the first port of call. People come to you, they talk about it. You go, right, okay, so. You probably need to see this person, you need to talk to this person, you need to do this. And along that process, I'll do the bits that I can add to the mix that'll help you do that process. And that's kind of what we do.
And that's about building a team of people around you, isn't it? You know, But like, especially like, I know some of the work you're moving into and the people you're working with, and you're joking about like that being wishy-washy. What are you talking about? Because that is the way the world sees it, you know, that dirty word holistic that people like to throw around now. But, you know, alcohol, sugar, all that stuff's not good for you. And people going away, like you're saying, it's good to go away for a break for 2-3 days, drink loads of alcohol, eat loads of rubbish. How is that good for you? Like, none of that is actually good for you. You know, the breakaway is good for you, but how much better would you feel if you went away and ate clean and drank fluids and got your 8 hours sleep, or your, it's not all about your 8 hours as you've told me before, but, you know, got your good REM sleep and all, that's, and we're talking about like the Marines, the Paras, SF world, that's elite level world. And how do we fuel our system? Well, we eat what we want. We drink as much alcohol as we can. You know, no one cares about nutrition. Well, they didn't when I were in. No one did. So half the guys smoke. You know, it's like they used to. I don't think many people smoke these days, do they? I don't know. You know, it sounds wishy-washy, but if you want to be elite level, do elite level things. It's not, I don't see it as wishy-washy anymore. I see it's the way you should be living. Like, you're not treating your body when you, I understand you can drink in moderation. Every single person is different. And I'm not there to tell people not to drink at all. I've chose not to drink because it's not good for me. It costs me more than money. And yeah, it doesn't add value to my life. I always look at things. Does it add value to my life? No. Right. It's not coming into my life then. Simple as that. You know, everyone's different though. Some people do, like you said, going to the pub, having a drink with a friend. You know, if it is just one or two pints, obviously there is a lot of benefits to that, isn't it? You know, that is a time when men open up.
And it opened for a lot of people who are just, you know, because of their personality type, they're not very open people, and they need a little bit of confidence. And, you know, people say about Dutch courage, and I think there is something. I grew up in a pub. I understand the value of, you know, Dutch courage as it is that you've got people who really struggle to be sociable, but they have a drink, and I'm talking a drink or two.
Yeah.
They become sociable. So all of a sudden they start talking, and then, you know, they wake up the next morning and go, you know, and it's not the alcohol. Yeah. It's the fact that they've instigated and opened a conversation, and, you know, and this is, you know, again, our generation, you know, a lot of people met their partners in pubs because there was Dutch courage, and there was, oh, I'm actually going to go and talk to this person that I wouldn't have had the confidence to do beforehand. So I think everything kind of has its place. I think it's just how it's utilized, isn't it? And it's not.
Why I'm single.
I'm sure you don't. I'm sure you're not like an in Dutch courage. But it is those things, and there's so many parallels, I think, between so many things. And, you know, we talked about the military and professional sport, and I think there's so many parallels there of this institutionalized thing. But this institutionalized thing that people thoroughly enjoy, right? Is that a lot of people, you know, a lot of my friends that have joined the military, they joined it because they want to be institutionalized. They're like, I want to be part of something, and I want to feel a part of something, and I want to be part of a community that I've got purpose and I've got meaning and I've got this, that, the other. And they love it.
Everybody wants to be a part of something, you know. Yeah. The best times in your career are your tours of duty. And that's not because you're getting the rounds down every day, although that might be an element. It's because you are living the basic lifestyle. You have no phone. You're hand washing your kit. You're just around the lads. You're playing games of cards. Everything is back to basics. You're so stripped back. There's no worries of this world. You're not worrying about bills or anything like
social
that
media.
Because I'm worrying about social media. There's none of that stuff. You know, it's just basics. And that's why I believe that lads miss, like, Afghanistan. They miss going on tour, and it's not the adrenaline days, which are, you know, sometimes few and far between. They definitely got fewer as my tours went on. It's the time away from this busy world that we live in of stress and dramas, and you're over there, and the only thing you have to worry about is, you know, I don't like the term, but who we conceive the enemy to be. That's the only thing you have to worry about over there. That's it. Like, look after your brothers. Simple world, simple living. You know.
And again, it's that camaraderie, right? That's always something that's always, you know. And I thought about the military. You know, it was a path for me. It was, you know, I did PE. You know, and a lot of my friends, they went in the military. And it was because it was sort of, you're looking for a direction, and you're wanting something to do that you know you're going to be kind of good at, that you know, I was always a big fan of discipline. I'm like, look, I like kind of being told what to do. I kind of rebel against it a little bit as well, but I kind of like being told what to do, because then that gives me direction and I don't have to think about that direction. And I know that ultimately, because the equation that they've worked out is that if I follow this, I'm going to be this at the end of it. And I always enjoyed that about sport, where you had a great coach in sport, you just trust them.
Yeah.
You go, right, yeah, cool, I'll just do whatever you tell me. You tell me to do that, as stupid as it might sound, I'm going to do it, you know? Yeah. And I had certain coaches along the way who would kind of play on that principle, where they'd be like, I can literally tell these people to do whatever I want. And then and you'd end up doing something goofy, and they'd be like, why did you do that? So, because you told me to.
Yeah.
You know? And
And the beauty of that, of what you've learned from that, and then you've learned yourself, and now you've created your own community, you know, just as kind of I have, in essence, you know, like we always want community, and you've now, you know, your passion and purpose, you're doing it. And now you're creating a community around that. No one escapes the need for community, but, you know, you're almost becoming the head of your community in a way.
Yeah. So tell me, the mentoring thing, tell me more about the mentoring thing. Where, you know, what are the plans? Where do you plan on taking it? You know, you said about some events that are going to be happening, and is that bringing that community together, your internal community, to then bring the outside community into that internal community and let them utilize their skill sets or things like this? So what's happening in the world of Laird and Co?
Yeah, so, you know, day to day, it's one-on-ones, and I'm also constantly self-development and going on courses myself to learn. It's mega important. I think more people need to be doing it. And then looking down the line, I'm going to be running events. I'm building up a team of people. Some are on the website right now, some aren't on yet, but they will be coming soon. And they're just people that I value, that have an expertise, and they'll come along as guest speakers and facilitators. Big thing for me is events. They shouldn't be, I don't want to create events where people leave motivated. Like, you know, they come and get this high, and then that high lasts for what, 2-3 days, and then they go back to the daily life. I want to create events that create real tangible change in their life that's ongoing. And then the look would obviously be from an event when people come, then you take some of those people on as your one-on-one clients, and you create accountability groups, and then you all grow together. You know, there's four aspects of growth in my eyes. You know, you've got mental growth, physical growth, emotional growth, and spiritual growth. And if you're not growing all four of those things, however they look to you, then you're not growing to your full potential and purpose and that you could be. So I want to delve into all them with people and find out how that looks to them. Right, now let's create something and move forward with that. So, and that's how I see the events being catalysts to that. And then also, you know, events down the line can almost be accountabilities to that. Come and add some more tools to your tool belt, and then move forward again and all grow together. And yeah, create a community in essence with that. But I just want everyone to grow. You know, I want to see people's passions, you know, fulfilled. There's too many people that do not fulfill their purpose and passion in this world through whatever self-confidence, anxiety, that, you know, not thinking they're good enough. I've dealt with all those in the past. I've been through it. So when I've done, you know, I want to do some more talks, more public speaking at different events and facilitate. There's other companies I know out there that I've helped facilitate, and I enjoy doing that as well. It's not all about, the last thing I want is to be like a face and sell my face of something. I'm quite happy in the shadows as well. The only reason why you see me is because I'm creating something that I need to share, but, you know, I'm quite happy in the background helping as well. So yeah, facilitating, speaking about transition, you know, and just sharing. I don't teach, I share my experiences, share how I've dealt with it and how I think I can help others deal with stuff. And that's how I move forward with it. So, yeah.
Exciting times. So there's various aspects that we kind of talk about a lot. We talk about performance.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about physical performance. We talk about mental performance. So how does performance play a role in your day? I mean, you said you haven't been back to jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Time being, but movement plays a part in your life. So what does a day in the life of Sam Laird look like?
Day in the life of me. So I've got negotiables and non-negotiables with the start of my day. So start of my day, starts the same every time. I walk in, have a cold shower. If I'm somewhere else or out and about, everyone's got cold water somewhere. So I always find cold water, whether it's in the river, sea, shower. Then I do a morning reading, which is like a daytime encouragement, which is a Christian thing. And then I do my morning Bible reading and then I pray. A lot of people can just relate that to meditation, if you will. And then I go for a dog walk. If I'm somewhere else, I'll go outside. Getting grounded's nice if you've got the opportunity. I believe in that barefoot on grass stuff as well. I don't do that every morning, but you know, it's important that you get out, get grounded, get in nature, movements, have some silence. I do not touch my phone until my morning routine is done. Categorically, never touch it. So don't check it. It's on silent. When my morning routine's done and I'm happy that I have started my day off in the right way, then I'll let the outside world in. Not until that moment. Because once I am on Facebook, but I don't check Facebook at all.
Yeah.
But I am on Instagram. So that's the outside world. Although I control who I follow and I only follow people that interest me or that I would see as positive light, none of that comes in until I'm ready for it. Then I will exercise in the day. How exercise looks to me at the minute. Generally, you know, yesterday I did 6.5 mile nasal breathing run. Generally like 5K. I'm happy with a 5K nasal breathing run. And then I'll swing my kettlebell around in the back garden for, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes. I love kettlebells. I think they sort your core out. I love the fluidity of it. Again, it's almost like a meditation as well. So I don't train for aesthetics, although, you know, you're going to look physically athletic if you train and eat well. I intermittent fast every day, so I don't eat till 12. Okay. And I stop eating at 8 o'clock at night. Generally, I end up stopping about 7 anyway. And during the week, kind of 6 days a week, I try and eat, you know, as clean as I can. I'm never going to be that guy. So if I'm around someone's house and they're cooking you dinner and they offer you dessert, I'll have it, you know. But if I'm in my own house, my own facilities, you know, I'll eat clean. So that's kind of the day to day with me. You know, I do like having challenges and goals to work towards, physical and mental and all that. So they're all important. You know, I've always competed at something. Like in the Marines, I did run it. I competed at a 50-mile race in the Falklands, a team. We won that. You know, I've competed in boxing, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, MMA, judo. Like it is an important aspect of me, but not to be better than someone else. It's just I am a goal-driven person. So for me to train and so for me to go back to Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I'll go back, which I will go back soon, and I'll already know in my head I want to compete in that competition on that date, and I'll work towards that goal. That's how that works. But for guys, just day-to-day physical activity, as long as I've moved, sweated, I'm very happy. I'm not too worried about facts and figures. I don't worry too much about my weight. I monitor it just to see where I'm at, because if I'm not training so much and my weight's going up, I know that's not muscle mass going on me. So I can monitor it that way, but I'm not religious with numbers per se. But yeah, okay. I always mix it up. So I'll go through phases of running, then I'll do a strength phase. Then, I'm constant. It's like hybrid fitness really fascinates me. I want to be fit. I want to be strong, but I want to be healthy. That's the big thing.
It's a terminology where we're getting very, very familiar with is the hybrid kind of term, where people are looking at, look, we want to be multifaceted. We want to be able to do multiple things, which I think is more, I think particularly people, as they get a little bit older, they're like, hold on, you know, I've been trying to refine this one thing and do this one thing very well, very well. And now I think people look a little bit more openly at it. And I think it's a more, you know, it's a more valid thing now. I think fitness, it's, you know, people really are chasing aesthetics or performance. People are like, hold on, whoa, we marry these together or you kind of get the best of both worlds to some degree. So give me some very, very punchy kind of rationale behind them. So the cold shower, what's the rationale behind the cold shower?
So obviously, look, there's loads of scientific benefits with regards to immune system, and apparently that boosts your serotonin and all that. It hits your vagus nerves, all that great stuff. I get in it because it's a mental win for me straight away. Don't think about it. Get straight in the shower, it goes on cold. I don't have a hot shower before it, straight on cold, I'm under it. Before I've even really thought about it. For me, that's just a mental challenge straight away in the morning. It's a win. I look at wins in the morning. That's a win.
Right, there's only a few people get what I mean here, but are you a back or a front guy?
I put my head under straight away.
Front wears.
Yeah, yeah.
Because yeah. it's the neck that's all
when it rolls down your neck.
The next nasty bit in my view, but there's the foot and the back people. The people who are going forward and the people going backwards on the cold shower front.
It hits top of my head so that it goes down wherever.
So you got the cold shower. You mentioned about intermittent fasting. Is that something just through trial and error you've come about, or is that something that was led by science, or was that something that just fits your day-to-day schedule, or
bit of everything? So trial and error is a big one for me. So I have. Look, so I don't shrug off anything that people say about stuff. So I'll always try it for myself. And I do look at the science behind stuff, but I've tried everything. I've tried keto. I've tried paleo. I went vegan for 6 weeks. You know, I've tried all these things and monitored how I feel. And ultimately, I've felt my best at intermittent fasting in the fact that it doesn't even matter so much what I eat when I intermittent fast. My body seems to stay roughly the same. Yep. But my energy levels are good. I feel sharp when I'm on it. But I do naturally eat less now. I intermittent fast, and it promotes me to eat clean. So for me, multiple things, and it does suit my lifestyle. I'm quite happy that I don't need to eat till 12 o'clock because I get up early. You know, I'm up between 5 and 6 in the morning. I can be so productive in the morning. I get my morning, you know, during lockdown, my morning routine turned into 3 hours, you know. Yeah. Like my morning routine can be as quick as 15 minutes if I just do the reading and get a look at some. But you know, if I've got the time, I'll make my morning routine 3 hours, and then you get your work in and all that. And I've done all that, and I've not had to think about food. All right, I do have a black coffee, and there's pros and cons of caffeine. You know, I like caffeine, and I try not to have it kind of after 2 o'clock, but you know, occasionally I will. But yes, so black coffee is all I have in the morning up until 12 o'clock, and I'm more than happy with that. I feel very productive. I eat high protein, low carbs, eat clean, but I find if I ever go through a phase of I'm getting lightheaded when I stand up, that's just my body telling me I need some more carbs. So I add some more carbs into my diet. So I feel like I'm quite in tune with my body. So again, it's not like looking at the deep science behind everything, facts and figures, although I do find it interesting. I don't engross myself in all that. I know how I feel. I know if I want to put on mass, what to do. I know if I want to lose it, I know what to do. You should know how your body reacts at our age.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, how about you?
I'm going to very briefly talk to you about your faith.
Okay.
Very briefly, because we always said when we did this podcast, we'd never talk about politics or religion.
Oh, we don't have to.
It has to be very brief. So, you said about sort of religion. Is that something that you found sort of later in life for you? And you put it akin to meditation, which again, I think is a nice sort of way to sort of align with other people.
You know, it's as simple as, you know, brush over it. I became very unhappy in my last kind of year or two in the Marines and began to search, found my faith. And through that, I looked at the way I was living my life. It was a big catalyst to wanting to be a better father, to stop doing the things that weren't good for me. And I looked at the military as actually a dark world. I actually seen it's quite a dark world, just the way it was operating at the time. And that is actually why I ended up leaving. And then I joined a church community. Obviously, I'm a Christian. And that's obviously everything I do is rooted into my faith. It is the most important thing to me. But through that, only good things will come, you know. At the end of the day, love your neighbor as yourself. You know, if I do that, then I don't need to, although, you know, on my social media, I usually put a scripture at the end of each thing. I make people aware of my faith, but I don't believe I'm one of those people that tries to judge and throw things down people's throat all the time. At the end of the day, I'll live my way in a transparent way. People can see that, and people can ask me questions if they want to ask me, and I will gladly talk about it and direct them, you know, if they ask me. So, yeah.
Cool. Now, how's fatherhood?
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fatherhood is the best thing without a doubt. Yeah.
We talk a lot about kind of indirectly kind of about family and about, you know, the importance of, you know, everything right down to kind of what we do with, you know, the products that we have, where everything is about consideration of what comes next. Mm-hmm. So for us, it was really important to us that people understand the kind of caffeine narrative that we talked about, where we don't want people getting home after a day's work and being tired. Mm. You know, and if we went down the traditional route, that's what we'd be doing. We're like, we're encouraging people to actually go home tired and finish the day in this kind of, you know, pent up sort of way in that they want to sleep when they need to get home and actually spend time with their family, be that a partner, be it, you know, family, kids, whatever it might be. And it's refining that. You know, when we talk about performance, we talk about, and again, it's that term, that holistic performance, where we're looking at, you know, you've got 24 hours in a day and everybody wants to perform throughout those 24 hours. And whatever they, whatever tools and modalities they use to do that is entirely up to them. But it's important for us that the times when, you know, we have these kind of peaks and these troughs of different things, that we're peaking and troughing at the right time. So sleep is all about making sure that there's that trough, but also that peak at the same time. And if you get the peak and the trough of sleep right, you'll sleep well. If you don't get the peak or the trough right, it doesn't work that way. So it's all about mastering those things. And we talk about peaks and troughs in the morning, peaks and troughs in the middle of the afternoon and all the time. So, you know, family is a big thing to us. So it's a fun time, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. And as you're saying, like, you know, everything we've talked about here, you know, whether it be faith or mental health or physical health, all of that comes down to being a better parent, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's, you know, like you said, if you're drinking too much and eating too much sugar and you're having these big sugar crashes, you're not used to your kids, are you? Because all you're going to want to do is lay on the couch and have a nap. You know, it's your physical health. You want to be doing stuff for your kids. I want to be that granddad that's running around with grandkids. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to be that overweight person that can't do anything. So my physical and mental health is priority for my daughter, if nothing else. So yeah, it's my daughter's just another driving force. She's a big why for me.
Yeah.
And you know, you're a father. So, you know, I didn't know what love was until I had a child. And when I had a child and realized what love was, it was a game changer. Talking about transition, that's transition. Becoming a parent, you know, that's transition. And you can't be who you were before you're a parent. You have to change. You straight away become a role model. And that person is going to, whether you like it or not, is going to mimic you in life. They're going to watch you and see what you do. And that's how they learn. So if you're not watching your actions, you know, you're going to see the repercussions of that in time, you know, as they get older. You know, I know they have other influences. Don't get me wrong. When they go to school, they say school's a bigger influence than their parents. But, you know, you're a big driving force of how your children are going to turn out, and also
how they deal with things at school, right?
100%, 100%. So
you learn how to deal with things in the moment, you learn how to deal with things outside of the moment, right?
Exactly. And I love it. I love deep conversations. I love talking about how the mind works and life lessons and stuff, and I love talking about that with my daughter. We have some amazing conversations, and that I always want that open communication. You know, she's 12. Everyone keeps warning me off, there's change coming. And, you know, there was change when she went to high school. She's in year 8 now. Seen some big changes there. But the relationship never changes. You know, they might become a little bit more closed off with certain things, but that's okay. They're growing up. But yeah, that parenthood, best thing in the world, biggest gift I have, my daughter. Yeah, without a doubt.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, We've been on for about an hour and 20, I think. So, and covered some quite in-depth sort of topics. But thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. And we hope to hear from you in the future. And we'll have some events and things coming on. So hopefully you might be a part of those events and other things going forward. But thanks for following us and thanks for being a part of our community.
No, I really appreciate you having me on, by the way, because I've followed you for years. So, you know, when you've asked me to be on, it meant a lot to me because I really value your content and the stuff you do. So I really appreciate it. And I hope all your stuff keeps going the way it's going, which I have no doubt it will.
Amazing. Well, thank you again for your time and we'll speak again soon.
Cheers. Thank you.
If you enjoyed the podcast, click subscribe and please leave a review. And thank you for listening.